Okay, thank you. Good afternoon. Welcome, everyone. A call to order the meeting, Senate Committee on Workforce. Today is Monday, April 10th, 2017. I just want to make a brief announcement that we're going to change the order on the agenda a little bit. We're going to do work sessions on Senate Bill 201 and 214, and then we're going to move to have a public hearing on the future of the State of Oregon workforce, what's happening with public employees, and then we will hear Senate Bill 299 after that. So I just wanted to give everybody an update on that in case people wanted to follow the schedule. So we're going to open a work session on Senate Bill 201. Ask Deborah to summarize the bill. Welcome, Senator Gelser. We're starting with a work session on Senate Bill 201.
Senate Bill 201 was introduced at the request of the Senate Interim Committee on Education for the Oregon Public Universities. The committee held a hearing on this bill on March 6, 2017. The bill establishes that remuneration paid to eligible employees who was hired in a qualifying position by a university with a governing board on or after August 29, 2003, or on or after December 31, 2017, and who is living and performing services within the United States is taxable income under Oregon law during the period of employment with the university. The Dash 1 amendment replaces the proposed statutory change with a provision establishing that for members of the public employees retirement system who was hired by the university with a governing board in qualifying position on or after August 29, 2003, and on or before December 31, 2016, and who resided and performed services in the United States for that university, remuneration is paid in return for those services during a period of continuous employment is taxable income under Oregon law.
Yeah, ask for a motion.
Yeah, Chair Taylor, I move to adopt the Dash 1 amendment stated 3217.
Senator Knoat moves to adopt the Dash 1 amendment stated 3217. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? And I'm going to, hearing none, the amendments are adopted.
Chair Taylor, I move Senate Bill 201 as amended without recommendation as to passage, but with the amendments, and request that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means.
Senator Knoat moves Senate Bill 201 without recommendation as to passage, but with amendments, and requests that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. Is there any discussion?
Yes, Madam Chair. I am going to be a no vote on this, and part of the reason, this is not a principle issue for me. This is a policy issue. I also want to flag the members down in Ways and Means to take a careful look at this, and so, you know, maybe I'll change my mind if this pops up onto the floor, but for now, I'm just going to be a no.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Knoop. Debbie, can you read the roll call, please?
Senator Gelser?
Aye.
Senator Hansel?
Aye.
Senator Monica Anderson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Knoop?
No.
And Chair
Taylor? Aye. The motion passes. Close the work session on Senate Bill 201. Open a work session on Senate Bill 214. Ask Deborah to summarize the bill.
Senate Bill 214 was introduced at the request of the Senate Interim Committee on Education for the Oregon Public Universities. The committee held a public hearing on March 6, 2017. The bill provides that postdoctoral scholars employed by a public university or the Oregon Health and Science University, beginning on or after the effective date of the act, is not eligible to become a member of the Public Employees Retirement System, Oregon Public Service Retirement Plan, or the Optional Retirement Plan. It provides that OHSU may not offer an alternative retirement program to postdoctoral scholars beginning employment on or after the effective date of the act, and it defines a postdoctoral scholar.
Can I ask for a motion?
Yeah, Chair Taylor, I move Senate Bill 214 without recommendation as to passage and request that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means.
Senator Knoat moves Senate Bill 214 without recommendation as to passage and request that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. Is there any discussion? I want to bring to attention for those who are listening and here in the audience, there is a Dash 2 amendment out there. I'm going to go ahead and read what the Dash 2 amendment does. However, we are not moving the Dash 2 amendment. We're not putting that into the bill today. We did not have a hearing on the Dash 2 amendment, so I don't feel comfortable putting that into the bill right now. So the Dash 2 amendment, just so that everyone knows, changes the standard for classification from quote-unquote person to quote-unquote position, clarifies that postdoctoral scholars hired after program completion by an Oregon public university as tenure-track faculty or researcher may opt into either Oregon Public Employees Retirement System or the Oregon Retirement Plan. Scholars who elect PERS may retain prior investments in the Oregon Retirement Plan. So again, we're not actually moving that amendment. The bill will not be altered, but I just wanted to bring that to everyone's attention. I'm going to ask the clerk to call the roll on that again, please. Debbie.
Senator Gilzer.
Aye.
Senator Hansel.
Aye.
Senator Mona Sanderson.
Aye.
Vice Chair Camille.
Aye.
Aye. The motion passes. Close work session on Senate Bill 214. And now we are going to open an informational meeting on the future of the state workforce. And I'm going to call Madeline Zeich and Katie Koba to talk to us a little bit about this. I want to just remind the committee what we're talking about here. Through our various conversations of PERS, and I think all of us know prior to the session starting, there's a lot of discussion about what does the future of the state's workforce look like. We obviously have a tremendous number of public employees, and they are going to, we have DAS here, and they're going to explain to us the makeup of the state's workforce, and they're going to talk to us about things such as the average retirement age, how basically we want to make certain that our workforce is stable and that we are an attractive place to work and people want to come and be public servants like all of us. So I'm going to turn it over to who's going to start? You will start. Okay, great. Thank you.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Katie Koba, State Chief Operating Officer and Director for the Department of Administrative Services. With me is Madeline Zeich, the Chief Human Resources Officer for the state. And we have slides for you that have a lot of numbers on them, and we'll be moving through those fairly quickly. A lot of information for you, but hopefully at the end of our presentation, you have a sense of what we're thinking about in terms of the future of the state workforce and what we're working on. So when I came to the Department of Administrative Services, obviously in conversations with the governor, and then also in conversations with ELT, which is the Enterprise Leadership Team, and that's a group of about 24 state agency directors, and we meet every other week and talk about key issues that are really driving the enterprise of state government. These, in the course of both my priorities as well as the Enterprise Leadership Team priorities, summarize a lot of the things that we're thinking about in state government. And for me personally, things like customer service, excellence in government, leadership development has been an issue that I've been working on for many years, even in my previous role as director of the Department of Agriculture. Certainly for the governor, priorities around equity in state government, transparency and accountability, things that you've heard a lot about. And so, as you can see, leadership development is one of those priority areas. That moves as well into workforce development. But for us in particular, we've been focused in the last 3 years about leadership development in the state's workforce. And as we look at the statistics and as we know that people are eligible to retire and retiring, and as we think about what is the future workforce for the state of Oregon and what are the leaders in terms of that workforce, what kind of people are they, what kind of training are they getting, what kind of levels of accountability are we holding them up to as managers in state government? And I can tell you, I tell this story a lot when I talk about state government and the kind of people that we want to attract to state government. Those of you know me, my career has been in public service in the state of Oregon, as was my parents. And so we've got a long history in our family of public service. My daughters, who are now 26 and 24, they're entering their high school years, and I'm having a conversation with them about, I've been in public service, your dad's involved in public service, your grandparents have. I said, are you interested in public service? And what do you think their answer was? No. And so that, unfortunately, is what we hear from a lot in terms of the younger generation. And we also know that those of the younger generation that we do entice into state government, they think about their work differently than we think about our work and what motivates them day in and day out and the kind of work environment that millennials are more in tune with than perhaps Matlin and I are in tune with. So these are a lot of the things that we've been thinking about from a state perspective. I can tell you we don't have all the answers by any means, but these are the kinds of conversations that we're having, and how can we reach out and really develop the expertise that we currently have within state government, and how are we drawing the best and brightest that we can and encouraging them to come to state government. So as part of the enterprise leadership process, and you can slip to the next slide, what we decided to do was to develop statewide values for the enterprise of state government. This has not been done in state government before, and we spent a lot of time reaching out to state employees and to agencies and working and identifying these statewide values for the enterprise of state government. These would be complementary to individual agency values. They wouldn't supersede those. But as you can see on the board, these were the four values that that we came up with. Integrity, being honest and transparent regardless of the situation. Accountability, own and take responsibility for the quality of outcomes for Oregonians. Excellence, collaboratively manage the resources we are entrusted with to achieve the best possible outcomes for Oregonians. And equity, commit to fostering an environment where everyone has access to opportunities and benefits. After developing these four enterprise-wide values, we've taken the next step in terms of identifying competencies that we expect all managers to have that lead up to these values. And now we're going through and doing a skill gap analysis of training that we provide to managers to see if that training is supporting those competencies that we've identified that we want every manager to have, and if not, what are the kinds of training that we need to put in place to make sure our managers are in that space. So Madeline is going to go through a number of slides with statistics, but I would just ask you, from an overarching perspective, as we look at all of these numbers, it really is about how we're getting our future leaders into state government and our future workforce, and what does that workforce look like. I think all of us sitting here know that the issues that we deal with are not getting any easier. They seem to be getting more complex. And it truly does take a good employee to be able to carry out the mission of state government and, frankly, to implement the laws that you all pass and entrust us in the executive department to move forward and implement. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Madeline, unless there are any questions for me.
Good afternoon, Senator Taylor and members of the committee. As Katie Koba mentioned, I'm Madeline Zeik. I'm the state's chief human resources officer. Thank you for the opportunity to come and speak with you today. This is something that I'm really passionate and excited about. However, in the interest of time, I'm going to try and blast through some of this because I know you have a jam-packed schedule. When I thought of the kinds of things that you might want to know about, I thought about five areas: workforce demographics, and we're going to go through some of the data, a little bit about the benefits that state employees have, some information about turnover and retirements, recruitment and retention, and workforce strategies. And then hopefully we'll have some time at the end for questions if you have them, and I'm always happy to go ahead and bring more information to you as you see fit. So a little bit about our demographics here at the state. I want to make a disclaimer first, and you'll probably get tired of me saying this, but we have a bit of a data problem in state government. So all the data that you're seeing requires a lot of manual work. So if you see some other reports elsewhere and you say, boy, these just don't really fit, I just wanted to put that out for you. And then when I'm saying workforce in this presentation, I'm referring to the executive branch only. So as far as the number of employees we have in the executive branch, we have approximately 40,000 employees, the majority of which are full-time, but we also have part-time and intermittent employees. The majority of our employees are also represented by bargaining units. We have about 3,600 supervisory managers, and we have 547 classifications within the state system. So I will tell you that's a lot of classifications. It's something that we're working on in some other projects that I may have a chance to talk to you about moving forward. A little bit about the workforce and the location here in Oregon. Not a big surprise, the majority of our positions are in Salem, but we do have also a growing population in Portland, and then we have state employees in every county in Oregon. The workforce by budget program area, so you will see that the majority of our employees are in human services, then followed with public safety. We also have employees that serve in natural resources, administration, economic and community development, consumer business services, and education. And then a bit about the workforce by service category, and you'll hear me talk about this a little bit more. The vast majority of our employees are what we call the professional category, and that's an EEO category that we use for federal reporting. And so in the professional category, we have employees that work in technology, accounting, engineering, our economists, those sorts of employees. We also have employees in administrative support that include administrative executive support, public service representatives, office managers, et cetera. Our protective services workers that I know you're very familiar with, corrections, state police troopers, criminal investigation, and paraprofessionals, so our mental health workers, human services workers, dorm counselors, some corrections workers. Our officials and administrators include the governor agency heads, the principal executive management series, or what we call the PEM series in our classification system. And then we also have technicians and skilled craft workers and maintenance workers. So we have a wide variety of employees doing many different things within state government. A little bit about the ethnic composition of our workforce. Our workforce is primarily Caucasian, and we're really looking to diversify the workforce. We've had some collaborative opportunities with the governor's office to do some direct outreach with some of the other communities that are not well represented in our statistics, and we're meeting with some of those communities through the governor's office to talk about how to diversify our workforce within the state of Oregon. I don't have numbers to share with you today, but I've heard from those that are working on some of our data for the affirmative action reports that we're doing better, and I don't know exactly what better means, so I don't want to give you bad data, but hopefully we'll have some information to share with you in the near future about how we're doing in diversifying our workforce. And then the gender composition of our workforce. You'll see that the majority of our workforce is female. We also use a system within state government to try and support pay equity, and it's called the Hay compensation system. So when we are establishing compensation for positions, we're looking at know-how, problem solving, accountability, and working conditions. We're also looking at other strategies. I know there's some legislation that is in the works regarding pay equity, but we've been working on for about the past 2.5-3 years some other strategies and having discussions within the workforce and with our employees.
Yes, sure. I think Senator Canope has a question, please, if you don't mind.
So thank you. So it sounded like you just said that the state has a pay equity issue problem. So could you expand on that a little bit? Has there been a study? Has there been a survey of the employee pay data? What do we know, and what are we doing to fix it?
Certainly. Senator Taylor, Senator Canope, we have had a study done. The state right now, women make about 89% based on the data that we have compared to males. We have had we had a study that was contracted with PSU, and they've been working with us to do some evaluation of that and see if we really have an issue, or because we have our data has some anomalies in it, that it's really more related to when we're just looking at the gender composition, is it really about the work? Are there education or experience requirements that are resulting in that, what looks like could be a pay inequity problem? So there are quite a few conversations, and we're continuing to look at some of the studies and classifications moving forward. My staff in classification and compensation do go out to the workforce every 2 years and do a market analysis. You may have seen the market analysis analysis report that is done by my staff, and they look at the market for different positions. We are required by law to be a market-based employer, and so since we have a merit-based system that is based on classifications that are developed based on those criteria that I gave you, we are in better shape than most, I would say, or some, but we still have work to do around that. And some of the things that I'm just going to get into some of the things we're doing, if that's okay, sure, that we've been talking about. One of the things that we found is that when we look at the historical information, particularly females that come into the workforce, sometimes that leads us to put them on a pay scale that isn't necessarily equitable from an internal equity process. So we've been working with our HR professionals to make sure that they're not only looking at salaries that people have when they enter our workforce, but what is the internal equity of that classification? What does that look like? Does it make sense based on education and experience and all of those things that this individual, whoever it might be, are placed at a certain level? So we're looking at that. We're also seeing that we need to develop a leadership pipeline for women coming into the state workforce. So we have a group that is working on that, developing some leadership programs for particularly females in the workforce in the STEM professions. That's something we're really interested in, but in other professions too. We're looking at trying to close our data gap. So when I talk to you about this, it's really pretty embarrassing that I can't give you great information about what the reasons are without people having to go through and do a manual process. So we have an IT system that we requested in the budget that will certainly give us more information and allow us to do a deeper dive into what some of the situation is. We have an internship program that begins this summer, working with colleges and universities to try and bring a diverse group of candidates into our workforce. And we also have some cultural competency training that we're working on in the CHRO that we'll be rolling out. We're looking at the potential of removing the salary history field from our application process, and that wasn't possible before in our legacy system, but we're working with our vendor to do that. And then looking at enhancing the diversity of our screening panels, because we've seen studies that say that when you do that, you're able to recruit a more diverse workforce. So those are some of the things that we're doing.
Just a moment, please follow up.
So you referred to the PSU study. Can you tell me what year that was, and is that something that's available and would be worthwhile for the committee to see?
Senator Taylor, Senator Knope, we had, I'm thinking it was 2014 that the initial study was done, I believe, and then we just had a recent refresh of it in 2015. So it wouldn't be real accurate data, but it could give us give you some information if it was something you were interested in.
Would you mind sending that to our office, to Deborah first, I guess?
Certainly, Senator Taylor,
we'll go from
I will.
There. Thank you.
This is really just a recap of what we talked about, the gender and ethnic composition of the workforce. Again, you can see that we have some work to do. This one I find really interesting, kind of goes back to what Katie was talking about, the workforce composition. So it wouldn't be surprising to you, based on everything you've heard about our workforce, that we have a larger population of Generation X and baby boomers in the state. And so we define that as a silent generation age 70 to 87, and we do still have 1% of our workforce that is choosing to work. I'm not sure that we have anybody that's 87, but I know there are people with 55 years or so of state experience. We also have, as I mentioned, a big chunk of our employees that are baby boomers, ages 51 to 69, Generation X, which is 35 to 50, and then the millennial generation that Katie talked about, that 18 to 34. As she mentioned, you'll see that the millennial population is lower than what we would like to see. And so we've had some conversations about why this might be the case, and I think that Some of it is the way that we, the kinds of positions we have when we go back to the professional positions, and those require a lot of education and experience and often tenure. And so I think that's why, that's one of the reasons why we have a big chunk of our baby boomers and our Generation X are with us, because that's such a large portion of our workforce. So big challenges there when they move along, and so we're going to talk about succession planning here in a minute. Average length of service by program areas, you'll see that our overall average is 10.4 years. And I think that I don't have really great data about the trending there, but what anecdotally what some of my my staff have said is the average tenure appears to be lower. It's trending downward, which would make sense with some of the millennials when we talk about that a little bit. And then you'll see in human services, that is where we have the highest level of turnover. And for me, that's not all that surprising. I worked in human services for many years. And so I understand, you know, that work sometimes is work where you have to leave it for a while. So that's not all that surprising to me where that would be.
Just
where
question.
We have our lowest tenure. Yeah.
Yes, Senator Montesantis.
Will you get into wages? I mean, do you have average wages in transportation, public safety, natural resources, et cetera? I'd be just curious if human services, if their pay is quite a bit less than any of the other categories that you have there. Yeah. If that makes a
Senator
difference.
Taylor, Senator Montesantis, I don't have that today, but we'll make sure and get it to the committee so that you have that moving forward. And then a little bit about the benefits. I didn't, you know, PEB is really, they're really the experts in our benefits programs and what we have in the way of health insurance. But I did just want to point out to you, these are the health care enrollment numbers for our most popular plan, which is our PPO. You'll see that employees do pay a portion of that. And I think that, you know, if you were interested, perhaps PEB could give you more information about that. But this is just a high-level overview of what employees are paying. We have a number of different plans that employees can choose from, and based on the plan they choose, the percentage they pay is different. And the percentages are determined, at least for represented employees, in the collective bargaining process. Turnover and retirement. I know you've been talking quite a bit about this in the PERS meetings, and I've been hearing about it. This is always a concern for all of us in HR, of course, because there are risks to this, such as, you know, knowledge and challenges. And again, we have people that have been in their jobs 55 years. Imagine what that looks like when they go and they have all that historical knowledge. I sit next to Katie, who's been with the state for 32 years, and I will never even know this much of what she knows in probably I've been here in the state 8 years. So anyway, I just think about that. Katie is a fine example of what we lose when people move on. So the definitions for this, the voluntary is a resignation. Involuntary is removal from trial service, dismissal, or layoff. And then, of course, we have a bar for retirement. And then the other is the end of an appointment, like a limited duration or an at-will status, or if someone dies on the job, so while they're employed. Yeah.
Senator Hanson?
So that's, I'm reading the small print underneath. That would be for 2016. So I want to make sure I read it. Little over 5% retired voluntarily. Of everybody that retired, 5%.
Senator Taylor, Senator Hansel, this is just the separation rate. So that isn't necessarily retired. It's their separation rate.
Retired would be in the 3%. Mm-hmm.
Thing, yeah. Correct. The lighter blue or the brighter blue or whatever we would call that. As I mentioned before, the turnover rate is 10.41%. As an HR person, I don't know that there's any industry standard or target, but I would like to personally see it, based on my experience, down to about 5%. And so that's my goal anyway, whatever, however that turns out. Turnover rates by age, you'll see that the baby boomers are leaving us, the silent generation to a lesser extent. But one of the things that I'm really interested in is that millennial and Generation X. You know, we expect that baby boomers are going to leave. We know we have retirement plans. We know people retire. But what's really going on with those two groups? And I think we're going to talk about strategies a little bit on that in just a minute moving forward.
That's not a quick question.
It's Senator Hansel.
On the previous slide, the total number, did you cover that before? What was the total number of turnover of all reasons?
Let me look.
Or actually, in each one would be helpful, too, if you have.
I'm looking back, Senator Taylor and Senator Hansel, and I don't think that I have the numbers behind the data, but I can certainly get that for you. Moving forward, turnover rates by length of service. And again, this is something where under 9 years, you know, we're experiencing quite a bit of turnover. So what's going on there? Is it really about the type of work we're doing? Is it the technology we have? Is it just by virtue of the fact that we've heard from baby boomers that they enjoy moving around and that's their culture?
Not baby boomers, the millennials.
The millennials. Thank you. Thank you. And then retirement eligibility. Our data says, and I've heard different numbers, but our data tells us that 26.92% of the state workforce is eligible to retire in the next 5 years. You'll see that we had a spike in 2012, and I think Director Rodeman talked about that a little bit in the PERS conversation.
Pardon me, Madeline, just to clarify, that does not include local public employers.
Senator Taylor, that's correct. This is
so
just the executive branch.
It's not teachers or anything like that.
Senator Taylor, that's correct.
Okay.
Yes.
And also for the committee, just remember we have roughly 40,000 state employees that work counting, and so you can do your own math if you want to quickly. You know, 27% of 40,000 gives you the numbers you're looking for.
Okay, moving forward. The same information, and I'm trying to look at time here because I know we didn't have much time moving forward.
No, you're fine.
Am I fine? Yeah. Okay, good. So agencies were more than 30% of the employees eligible to retire in the next 5 years. When I first ran this slide by, for example, the Department of Corrections, they said that for them it looks more like 54%. So, again, going back to the data disclaimer. But in any event, if you look at this slide, you'll see that these are pretty critical agencies for the state. Everybody's critical, but this is one that causes us some concern about risk. And when I get to the next slide, too, I'll share with you that some of these, in these agencies, this is where we have the most difficult to fill positions. Okay, recruitment and retention. So this is always, these are the kinds of things that keep me up at night. So where we have difficulties, and not surprising, this would be like many industries, but in the highly technical fields, which are information technology, engineers, planners, economists, auditors, also in high-level leadership, business IT managers, medical directors. In the medical field, we have a very difficult time because we have physicians and dentists and nurse practitioners and those sorts of positions that we need to fill. And as I mentioned, in healthcare, RNs are also a problem. It's difficult for us to compete in the medical world with some of our state salaries. A little bit about the primary drivers. So one of them is location. We talked about that a little bit. Many of our positions are in Salem. And a lot of times the business is actually conducted here. It's where the clients are, and this is where we have facilities. There's less opportunity for positions in Portland, which is usually a more diverse field for us to bring employees from. Commute times and commutes. People don't love that I-5 commute. I'm one that drives the other way in the morning. I come from Harrisburg, so even that way, which is a lot more rural, it's still an hour on I-5. So that's a couple hours of your life that you don't get back every day. So getting people to commute is often a challenge, and we don't have a great mass transit system for that. Perception.
Just a question.
Yeah.
Regarding workforce. Have you looked into, I know other industries are able to allow their workers to work by at home on the computer. I know my son-in-law does in Chicago, but has that ever been approached? Is that viable, or would it be just abused?
Chair Taylor, Senator Moniz Sanderson, we have looked at that, and we actually have a directive from the governor's office to encourage working remotely when it makes sense. We have many employees that do that, and I personally think they've been really successful. For many people, when they're given that opportunity, they really appreciate it. And certainly with the millennials, we found that's a way to bring millennials in. I always tell people if we think we're going to get millennials and sit them in a cube 8 to 5 Monday through Friday, probably not going to happen. So we have done that quite a bit when the work allows us to do that. It's been one of our strategies. Mm-hmm. They're usually telework agreements, so it lays out the expectations for employees and, you know, here's when you need to be available and here's how we reach you. So there's some structure around it. So we're not really concerned about people abusing it, as you said. Some perception around state employment. There are people that don't necessarily think that the state is the best place to work, and we're working on that. There are some individuals that they're not sure state employees are valued or appreciated. And we've gotten this from some surveys from employees. I think one of the things that we don't do well that we really need to capture on is the values basis of our work. So one of the things we find with millennials, and not just, I don't think it's just millennials, it's everyone, we offer a great opportunity in state government to make a difference and serve your community. And millennials in the Generation X are really driven by that when I talk to them. And I have a number of them that work for me and with me. So I think we need to do a better job of advertising what you can do to help things move forward. Some problems with the salary in certain areas, certainly in those difficult-to-fill areas, but we also compete with cities and counties, and sometimes they do a little better than we do. So that can be an issue for us. And then technology, I keep hammering on the technology, getting some of these new IT professionals in with some of the technologies we have, or even some of the millennials that have higher expectations than we're able to meet about how you're going to use technology to do your work. I think that's a challenge for us too. And then certainly career progression. We eliminated a lot of the mid-management positions here in the state in about 2011 to 2012. So we don't have a career ladder that you'd often see in an organization. But we're trying to work on that through some of the leadership pipeline activities that Director Koba was talking about. So I told you about all the problems. So now I wanted to talk a little bit about the strategies and what we're trying to do with the workforce. So one of the things we did in my office, I've been here 3 years. Time flies. It doesn't seem that long. 3 years. And so we did some restructuring in the office of the CHRO, moving from being a transactional personnel type division to really being strategic business partners with agencies. So we've been looking at some of the ways in collaboration with agencies that we can better help them meet their needs. One of our key initiatives is the Human Resources Information System, also known as HRIS, that I'll tell you about a little bit more, but that is in the governor's budget right now. We also have an intern program that we're super excited about, and that's going to start this summer. And I'll have a few more details as soon as we get the people recruited. But we're looking, I think, between 50 and 60 interns that will be spread out within a number of agencies, so we're excited about that. We also have heard, and we know, that we are not necessarily, we don't have the most user-friendly recruitment system. If anybody's ever filled out the state application, it's a big old long process. We're in the private sector, you know, we're seeing more resumes and a more streamlined process, which is particularly attractive to the group that we're trying to pull into the workforce. And we also know that onboarding has not necessarily been one of our strengths. So when I go back and I look at some of that data about people that aren't staying long, I think a big chunk of that is a management problem and that we don't have formal onboarding programs. And so we're working on that. In particular, we're starting with the executive level because, you know, for agency directors, we work so hard to get into the system and we find such great people. And then we say, here you go. So we're working on mentoring and onboarding programs, working on training and development programs, and we're also formalizing a succession management project. So looking, and we think we'll be able to use this new automated system to do some of this. We're looking at then for managers, there's a project called the Oregon Management Project that you may have heard about. And so right now we're focused on accountability and empowerment for managers, but we've also done some work around classifications and compensation. Okay, and so this is my shameless plug for the new HR system. This is actually the system that we have that we extracted this information from. Of course, not everybody has access to it. I think there are some like 14 or 15 codes, F codes and all those things that you have to put in to do anything in the system. So we're looking to replace that with something new and modern that certainly will allow us to provide better data, enhance data collection, do more workforce planning, and those sorts of activities. So I think that was all I had for you today, unless there's some additional questions. Or you had anything to add?
Thank you. That was great. Does anybody have questions? No, I thought that was very informative. I really appreciate that. You actually literally answered most of the questions that I had. So thank you for putting that together. That was really well done. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having
me. Okay. All right. So we're going to go ahead and close the informational meeting on the meeting on the future of the state workforce. And next we are going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 299. And I'm going to have Deborah summarize the bill, please.
Senate Bill 299 was introduced at the request of the Senate Interim Committee on Workforce. This is the first time the committee is hearing this bill. The bill directs the Bureau of Labor and Industries to study the issue of sick leave in Oregon. The Dash 1 amendments replace the bill, clarifies that employers located in a city with a population exceeding 500,000 does not include an employer who maintains a temporary establishment only, and this is with regards to the sick leave statutes. Clarifies that all employers may leave hours of paid sick time that employees may limit the hours of paid sick time that employees may accrue to 40 hours per year. Establishes that in the employee count for purposes of determining whether paid sick leave policy applies does not include the director of a corporation, member of a limited liability company, or partner of a limited liability partnership who has at least 51% ownership in one of those business types or a parent, spouse, or child of such individual. For employers with 10 or more employees, it changes the rate of pay for accrued sick leave used by employees paid on a commission or a piece rate basis from the employee's regular pay rate to a rate no less than minimum wage, and by employees who are paid on both an hourly, weekly, or monthly wage and by piece rate or commission basis at a rate equivalent to the employee's hourly, weekly, or monthly wage. It requires an employer with a sick leave policy, paid vacation policy, paid personal time off policy, or other paid time off program that is substantially equivalent and more generous to the employee than the sick leave laws to comply with the requirements of the sick leave laws at a minimum for the first 40 hours that the employer's policy provides per year. It amends the definition of payroll for purposes of workers' compensation law to exclude sick time pay as provided in sick time laws. It clarifies that the deduction of sick time leave for purposes of workers' compensation benefits does not violate the sick time laws, and it declares an emergency and is effective upon passage.
Okay. All right, so let's go ahead and bring up Paloma Sparks and Kristen Adams, please.
Good afternoon. For the record, I'm Paloma Sparks with the Bureau of Labor and Industries. Senate Bill 299 is the result of some work among mostly the people who were on the our rulemaking advisory committee.
So when we were, the original bill was adopted in 2015. We then did rulemaking following the 2015 session. In the 2016 session, there were some various bills, discussions about legislative intent, changes that were people were hoping to make in the legislation. We then did another round of rulemaking. In that round of rulemaking, we discovered some language in the statute that was rather restrictive or didn't allow us to make the changes that some advocates had wanted us to make. So in December of 2016, I came to the Interim Committee on Workforce and presented about some various issues that we had run into around sick time and identified some areas where some clarifications could be made. This session, we've continued to have discussions. The Dash 1 amendments are essentially the result of those discussions. You know, where do we actually need cleanup in the statute? So there's some essentially typographical errors in the bill where the language about work study. So work study students are excluded from the definition of an employee under the sick time law, but that language was written in such a way that it made it sound as if you had to be getting work study as part of a educational training program, not just also financial assistance program. So that's a cleanup we made. In the section that discusses carryover, it says or when it should say and. So this bill makes a variety of changes. It clarifies that language I mentioned about the work study students, clarifies the language around sick time accrual to make it very clear how accrual will work, how employees are paid on a piece rate basis. The original language in the sick time statute says employees who are paid at a piece rate or commission basis will be paid their regular rate of pay or minimum wage. Piece rate is a regular rate of pay under wage and hour law, so we need to take out the regular rate of pay language and just say they will get paid minimum wage. There's some other language that we've been working on because there are some employees who are paid at a piece rate basis sometimes and paid an hourly wage other times. Farm Bureau and various other interested parties want to make clear that that language means that they would get their hourly rate, whatever their hourly rate is. So that language is in this amendment. there's some clarification around counting employees. We still need to work on that. We're going to continue. I think we're probably going to all hustle out in the hallway and talk about it some more after this hearing's over. So we're continuing to work on the language about corporations, limited liability corporations, sort of similar to the discussion that you had in this committee around Senate Bill 779. Because what we want to make sure is that we're not in a position where businesses might be making employees corporate owners, so they would have limited, very small amounts of shares, but not have actual control in order to avoid compliance with sick time. So we're gonna all work together and make sure that what we're talking about is excluding people who are actually controlling the company.
Okay, so I'm sorry to interrupt you, Paloma. Can you clarify what you mean by we who we are, we're all gonna work together, what you're thinking of a plan, and
sure. So the rulemaking advisory committee has been made up of the AOI, the Association of Oregon Industries, myself, Family Forward, SEIU, Farm Bureau, Association of General Contractors, basically everyone right back there. That's who we're talking about.
Just trying to have it on the record. But yeah.
Even Senator Thompson?
Yeah, no, sometimes. So that's it. That's the basic core group.
Mm-hmm. And what are you, can you give us, in your view, what of the Dash One amendments, there's different sections here.
Mm-hmm.
And I just want to have an understanding of
sure.
things that you, since you're here representing Boley,
mm-hmm.
the things that it is your understanding of what's been kind of clarified, for lack of a better term, and then what things still need to be discussed.
So in section two, when we are talking about section two on page four, what is not an employee, the exclusions from employee,
mm-hmm.
where we're talking about LLC members and corporations.
Okay, so are you taking the approach of the things that have yet to be sorted out? You're just going to summarize those, the ones you've agreed on most of these, but
mm-hmm.
you're just going to highlight the ones so you still have some, you're still conversations going on.
Yep.
Perfect. Okay. So LLCs, which is, of course, a topic from before.
So, yeah. So we need to still work on that language. I think we're pretty close. We've been all in discussions. Now, these amendments didn't get done until Friday afternoon.
Okay.
So. It's all sort of fresh for all of us that we've had a chance to really look at them. So, like I said, after we're done here, we're going to go talk some more about this language. I think that the business interests aren't, when we said the 51% language that's in on page 4 and 5 that talks about LLCs and corporations, what we meant was the controlling ownership, and we didn't mean a single person. We meant sort of collectively. So that's language that we still have to work out to get to essentially what that meaning is. How do we need to have that language be written? Workers' comp has also mentioned to us that they're not comfortable with some of the language that was originally proposed to me and I put in at the request of some of the business interests. We're probably going to take that language out. That's sections 4 and 5. I think that is the issue where we're trying. Those are the only areas, as far as I know right now, where we have discussion points where we need to reach some compromise.
So to clarify, you're... folks are still talking about the LLC, the definition,
mm-hmm.
And then talking about, apparently in section 4 and 5, about workers' compensation.
Yes.
Okay. Tell me again about the worker compensation, what the issue there is.
So there has been a lot of discussions about sick time hours being counted as part of your payroll assessment under workers' comp.
Okay.
I think... probably other people can speak to this better than I can. This has been a proposal that we received. I think it was originally from the Association of Oregon Loggers. It hasn't gained, as far as I understand, it hasn't gained the support of MLAC. And so that's sort of where it is right now.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Does anyone have any questions for Paloma? Senator Hansel.
Yeah, Paloma, thank you very much for all your work on this. The one thing I want to make sure, at least from my own personal experience as well, on the 51% ownership interest, the 51% is really going to have to be defined, because part of the goal of these LLCs is that nobody has 51%. Because if you're 51%, then you have no tax break if you pass away, because you own the company, you have the majority. So all I know in our family situation and others, no one member wants to have, it doesn't do any good to incorporate if somebody's sitting there with 51% of the stock, at least in my experience. So you said it was corporately, well, the family obviously, but I really want to make sure that that's clearly defined. Otherwise, we might be creating another problem.
Chair Taylor, Senator Hansel, and I think
what you're mentioning and what we're sort of trying to get to, we just need to work on the language. We're not trying to limit it to an individual who owns 51%. I think we're trying to make it clear it's the actual controlling partners of the business, and we just need to figure out how to write that the right way.
Question?
Yes, Senator Hessel.
Would it not be, if you just said family members, blood relatives of the corporation? I mean, I know there's been some fear that a family will bring in 57 half ownerships, which doesn't make a lot of sense to me, and nor to them to give away corporate, you know, the power. But I think it all started off as far as family members are concerned, and I think that would be, you know, a way to define that down.
Chair Taylor, Senator Hansel, that'll be certainly one of the points that we will discuss and figure out if that's the right way to write this.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Any other questions for Paloma? Okay, go ahead.
Good afternoon, Chair Taylor, members of the committee. For the record, Kirsten Adams with Associated General Contractors, representing a very broad cross-section of Oregon's commercial construction industry, including rural and urban, highway and building contractors, both open and union shops, and small and large businesses. We support the Dash 1 amendments, realizing that there's more work that needs to be done. In particular, we support Section 1, Subsection 3B, which deals with employer location. This portion clarifies that employers are not considered located in a city with a population over 500,000 if they only maintain a temporary establishment in the city. This clarification is important for the construction industry because our industry is highly mobile, moving from location to location, as contractors complete jobs in different sites with their permanent location usually located elsewhere. Counting these temporary locations for the location of the business itself creates confusion for both the contractor and the employee. So for an example, a subcontractor with seven employees that's based in Tualatin could have a three-week job in Portland, and for this time period, the subcontractor sets up a construction trailer at the job site, and then at the end of the 3 weeks moves the construction trailer to Wilsonville. And given that the business continues to be run out of the Tualatin office, and the time in Portland was only 3 weeks, the subcontractor is clearly not located in Portland, and thus the employee shouldn't be considered as such for determining whether the sick leave for the company's employees should be paid. So without this clarification, both employees and employers in our industry will continue to have confusion about whether the sick leave should be paid or unpaid, and it makes the compliance and use of sick leave difficult. So thank you for allowing me to testify, and if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Okay. Any questions? Okay, thank you. I see Senator Thompson is here. You guys go to the front of the line.
Thank you.
Nice to see you. How are you doing?
Good, I think. Okay. Chair Taylor?
Chair Taylor, you're here to talk about Senate Bill 299, sick leave. What would you like
is
to
is that call? The one? Oh, yeah, it is. Chuck Thompson, Senate District 26, here to talk about Senate Bill 454, correct? That's my other testimony. Sorry.
We're on the record here. You're on the record here, Senator
Thompson.
We're
down in the last couple of weeks. Anyway, I just want to thank Paloma. I want to thank the group for working on this issue. It sounds like they're getting there. When they did the paid sick leave a couple of years ago, I came and testified in front of the House and Senate committee about the difficulty it would be to keep track of piece rate as opposed to hourly rate. And most of our employees that we have a base hourly rate that they doing all the jobs in the orchard throughout the year. And there's a couple times we do piece rate when we're pruning the trees and when we're picking the fruit at harvest time. And my concern was if you gauge this towards the times of when they're harvesting the fruit that they might tend to stay home and collect like piece rate, paid sick leave, instead of doing the harvesting. So it would put a huge burden on growers because most of the fruit and vegetables folks, all our stuff is perishable. And we get like 8 days to, when they tell us it's time to start picking your Barla pears, we have 8 days to do that or they'll go to mush. and we can't, they won't store. So very critical thing. And I think back when this was first proposed, I think there was some confusion. But I think the groups have worked on this now for the last couple of years. And I just say I'm in here in support of the group that's working, and I think they'll get to an agreement. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Any questions for Senator Thompson? Thank you for coming by.
You bet. Thank you.
All right, so let's go ahead and bring up Anthony Smith, Jenny Dressler, and Tim Baransack. Who wants to start? Okay.
Chair Taylor, Vice Chair Knope, members of the committee, for the record, Anthony Smith, Oregon State Director for the National Federation of Independent Business, here today to provide our take on the Dash 1 amendments. Specifically, the provisions in Section 2 that we've already talked about a little bit that deal with the LLCs and the partnerships. And I'm encouraged by what we've already heard from the prior panel. And it sounds like between what Senator Hansel was saying and Ms. Sparks was saying that we're on the right track there. And I did want to just maybe provide a little bit of an illustration of why that's a complicated issue and why we really need to get the language correct. So the way that the amendment is currently written says something to the effect of, as used in this subsection, employee does not include an individual or the parent, spouse, or child of an individual who is a voting member of the board of directors of a corporation and has 51% ownership of the interest in the corporation. And that same kind of 51% ownership interest language is then also used in the provisions that deal with LLCs and partnerships. And I think it might be helpful if I kind of describe what a family business could look like and how that might be complicated depending on the ownership breakup of that particular family business. So say you have a family business, it's five people in the family, two parents and three adult children. If you split that evenly at 20% interest for each member of the five-person family, not one person would have 51% control. And so for the purposes of counting your employees, none of those employees would be exempt. So all of them would be counted toward your employee count. Now, on the other hand, if you had the two parents, one of them owns 51%, the other owns 49%, and the children, the adult children who are actively involved in the business, but they don't actually own any percent of the business, then all of them are exempt because that one person had the 51% control. So I'm encouraged that we're kind of getting to where we need to be with the language. Just want to make sure that we get it right. And if we get it right, we will enthusiastically support this bill.
Okay, so just so I understand, Anthony, this is the one area of the bill that you have concerns with?
Yes, of the Dash 1s.
The Dash 1,
Chair Taylor, yes, thank you. This is particularly of importance to our members because our members tend to be, 70% of our membership, of the 7,000 members we have in the state, 70% of them have fewer than 10 employees. So we're right around that. This is the question I get the most issue I get the most questions about.
I have the same type of question. And I'll probably need Paloma to explain it to me, but if there are multiple families owning farms, huge farms, I would say three or four, and I know my family in Kansas does that. How will that impact multiple families? Same question. You have one family with five members, but what about multiple families?
Sure. Chair Taylor, Senator Montes-Anderson, I think that my colleagues here have a pretty good solution to present, and I'll just yield my time.
Chair Taylor, Senator Anderson, for the record, Tim Baransack, attorney at Dunn Kearney, representing the Oregon Farm Bureau today. I think that's one of the problems, I think, with this language currently, is that unless you had, if you've got three or four families, unless one family member has 51%, then those spouses, parents, children of that individual would be exempted, but none of the other controlling or family members, and I think that's something, as Paloma indicated, we're going to try and work on.
Just the microphones. Chair Taylor, members of the committee, my name is Jenny Dressler, and I represent the Oregon Farm Bureau Federation. We are here today to speak to the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 299. Anthony Smith clarified some of our concerns around the language specific to family members and how they're counted. Mr. Bernasek, to my right, is here to provide some technical expertise with regards to that provision, and I'll be submitting some testimony to the record on that as well. I wanted to focus on two of the other provisions that we are here to support in the Dash 1 amendments. The first being clarifying how paid sick leave is calculated for piece rate work. You heard from Senator Thompson about what that looks like in his operation and in his area with some of the tree fruit growers. In Oregon, the piece rate industries tend to be, for at least in agriculture, fruit, so berries and tree fruit and some of the stone fruit, and then as well as vegetables, fresh vegetables. And this has been an issue that started to come up around the workforce availability that Senator Thompson addressed regarding whether or not we can get crops out of the ground on time, or essentially some of the HR costs associated with hiring new employees to fill those spots. We have a farmer in the St. Paul area who grows vegetables and cherries, and for one of her vegetable crops, it's about an 8-week harvest window. And in 2014, she had 20 regular employees, and she had for the past 5 or 6 years 20 regular employees coming to harvest that vegetable crop. In 2015, when the sick leave law passed, she had 47 employees to come and harvest that crop, and then in 2016, she had 89 employees. And those are just employees that are subbing in, but for every new employee that comes onto the field, that's another day of training. We've got some new pesticide use reporting requirements, or not pesticide use reporting, but pesticide regulations that require some more in-depth training coming down from EPA. And so that's a day of training for each one of those new employees. So for her, that's kind of added to that burden. And while she's able, because she uses a labor contractor to fill those spots, it's just more of a burden from the farmer's perspective. So the clarification that Ms. Sparks spoke to is something that we appreciate, we've been working towards for the past couple of years, and ask for your support of that clarification in the bill. The other was addressed by the Associated General Contractors earlier, which is the temporary location fix. I don't know that it was discussed when Senate Bill 454 passed in 2015, which was the sick leave law, about how temporary businesses or those businesses that have a temporary location would be treated if they do work in Portland. By our read, essentially a reach back. And if you have a farm stand, or if you're at the farmer's market in Portland for 2 months on Saturdays, that the law currently pulls them into that Portland sick time threshold of 6 employees or more, as opposed to the Oregon sick leave threshold of 10 employees or more. So we are very supportive of that fix in the rules as well. And I think it'll help a lot of those folks who do direct market and some of the fresh market into Portland. So thank you for the opportunity to testify today.
Okay, does anybody have any other questions? Okay, thank you. Did you want to speak more? Do you have anything else you wanted to add? Or
Chair Taylor, members of the committee, again, Tim Bernasek. I guess one of the things, I think, keying off Senator Montes Anderson's question, that I think what's going to be problematic is trying to tie any of these control issues to a set number because of just the complex nature of how different entities organize. And listening to some of the concern in the hearing on, I think it was Senate Bill 779, that had concern about maybe a crafty employer creating an LLC maybe and granting some shady membership, you know, minimal membership interest, just to avoid the requirement that those employees be counted those employees be counted for purposes of sick leave. Our thought is that maybe what we need to do is tie this to the idea of voting or consent being required, because what we're really talking about are these employees, or are these owners that are exerting control and making decisions for the business. And the argument would be that those that have real ownership or control of the entity, maybe those family members, and those employees should not be counted. So I think what we're going to try to promote to address this issue, rather than some artificial number, is talk about, for example, for LLCs, the beauty of LLCs is that there's a lot of flexibility. You can have member interests that don't have a voting or control interest. They just maybe get financial rewards out of that. So investors, for example. So obviously that would be an avenue, as I think those that raise concerns with the LLC provision said, well, wait a minute, you'd just give these non-voting interests to employees and give them maybe a minimal profit-sharing interest or whatever, and now all of a sudden your whole workforce is not covered by the sick time law, which clearly was not the intent of Senate Bill 454. So our thought is, to turn that on its head, is that any member interest in LLC that has voting or whose consent is required before any decision is made for that business then would not be counted for purposes of sick time, because as onerous and as uncomfortable as many small business owners and farmers are with this whole sick time requirement, I don't think that they would be at a provision where they're going to give up control of their business to employees for the sole purpose of avoiding coverage under sick time. So I think that is a way of addressing these multifamily interests that Senator Montes Anderson was talking about, is you may have a family, three family members who have membership interest in an LLC, and believe me, I see them. I know these families. They're very, very complex structures, and I think the question is one of, do you have a voting control? Do you have the ability to shape the course of that entity? And if so, that then maybe the employee exemption should apply to you, because I think that's the spirit of what Farm Bureau was after when we talked about this family farm exemption, is if you're controlling, making decisions for that farm or that small business operation, then maybe coverage under this sick time shouldn't apply to you. So I think that's where we're coming in. Thank you.
Senator Hansel.
Chair and members of the committee, and thank you very much for that, because as a family member of three family corporations, what they just described there, I think, would work. That would, I think, answer the questions that have been raised, and I'd certainly be supportive.
Okay. Anybody else? Okay, thank you, Senator Hansel, and thank you for coming forward. So we are going to have Kate Newhall come forward, please. And I can barely read this faint print. Gentleman from Pocoon.
Cristobal.
Okay, sorry, it's written very lightly here. It's okay. How are both of you? Thank you for coming.
Good.
Holding thank off. You. So since I messed up your name, Cristobal, did you want to go first?
Yes. My name is Cristobal Redondo. Oh, sorry. Dear Chairman Taylor, Chair Taylor, and members of the committee, my name is Cristobal Redondo, and I'm with Pocoon. My father, Cristobal, also named that, was here with me earlier, but he had to leave to give my brother a ride to his other job. And him and my mother are both seasonal farm workers, and I also joined them in the fields as well when I'm not working. My parents have worked in the fields for over 25 years, and I'm here today to speak for them. The only thing my parents earn from their hard labor is a wage that only increases when the state's minimum wage goes up. Along with that, they have to put up with having no benefits. We were counting on the paid sick leave law, much like other laws that help farm workers to give us added benefits. We are both here today to say, even though it's not here, please don't roll back the paid sick leave law. Let's move forward, not backwards. Farm workers and people like my parents put food on the table, both in our own home and everyone else's, and we deserve better. It is only becoming harder for my folks who are aging, so I ask you all to please support us, and thank you.
Okay, thank you. I just wanted to clarify, you said, when I'm not working, I'm going to go work with my parents.
Oh, yeah, you know, I have a part-time at the bowling alley, and then when I have free time, you know, I'll definitely go along with tag along with them and help them out, you know.
That's quite the work ethic. I commend that. So,
thank you, Chair Taylor. Excuse me, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kate Newhall, here today representing Family Forward, and I'm going to deviate a little bit from my written comments because I think my understanding of this issue and sort of where we're going has been changing as we go through this. So, I guess I would start with, as you all know, Family Forward worked very hard with a coalition of others in 2015 to make sure that we enacted a strong paid sick time law. so that workers would actually be able to take time off when they or their family members were sick. We believe this is an important public health issue and a basic right to which all workers should be entitled. We definitely have stood firm in opposition to changes that we see as rolling back sick time or eliminating sick time protections for any workers, reducing them in any way. We've also always been open to truly technical fixes in the law. I think this is something that we want to make sure that we have absolutely right. But we will remain opposed to things that we think that mean any worker loses access to paid sick time or job-protected sick time. So I will start off by saying that I appreciate this attempt to clarify the sick time law, and even though there are a couple things that I still remain opposed to and have concerns about, I think there are many changes in the Dash 1 amendments that I do support and I do believe truly are technical corrections in nature. So let me start with the pieces that I have concerns about. The changes to the definition of an employer located within a population exceeding 500,000 and excluding from this temporary locations. This was an issue that came up in the 2016 rulemaking conversation, and it was also something that Family Forward wasn't necessarily opposed to excluding temporary locations. Our concern was that we wanted to have a time limitation on what truly is temporary. I think we wanted to be careful that we didn't create an exclusion for a location that might be technically temporary, but that stood at the same spot for a year, more than a year. I can envision a situation with potentially like a construction trailer or something that may not be a brick and mortar permanent location, but still is a coffee stand actively there all the time doing business in that location. So what we said through rulemaking was we were fine to exclude temporary locations from what counted as a location within Portland, so long as we put a hard set time limit on that. What we suggested during rulemaking was a 90-day limitation. So I think the construction trailer that you heard about in testimony just earlier of 3 weeks, that would be fine with us. That would still just truly be temporary. The farm stands that just come in for a one Saturday to sell at the farmer's market, that would be fine too. That really truly is temporary. But what we want to avoid is something that is technically temporary but stays in the same location year-round and all the time. The second concern that we have around the changes in Section 3 to the PTO policy and what an equivalent PTO policy is. Our intent always with this was to make sure that workers had access to 40 hours of sick time when they needed to take time off when their family member was sick. We believe if the changes contained in the Dash 1 amendments are adopted, that this could mean that some workers don't receive 40 hours of sick time each year. I think this is best illustrated through an example, and it's my understanding of what proponents of this provision want to achieve, is an example of an employer who has an equivalent PTO policy and they give their employees, say, 60 hours of PTO. Now, that's 20 hours more than what they would be required to do under the law. The issue is that if an employee who has that 60-hour PTO time takes 40 hours in the beginning of the year to take a ski vacation or whatever, that they then don't have any job protection left for them. And I think that piece is concerning to us. My testimony here says, I really appreciate the language in Section 2 around LLCs, and it was something that I feel like we can be fully supportive of. But as I listen to sort of testimony and concerns from others, it sounds like that's a piece that we're going to still continue to work on. But we do want to come back to just the original concerns that we raised in Senate Bill 779. I mean, I think our fear was that we don't want to create something that allows somebody to have an infinite number of LLC partners that then are exempted from the law altogether. I think the changes that I've heard being talked about of somehow tying it to some definite control and ownership stake over it. I hear that maybe 51% is a little bit too high. I guess I'd like to continue working on that and see what language, what other language might be proposed, and then look at it from there. I think we are definitely getting closer to this provision and figuring out a standard that we can all be supportive of. The last piece, I guess, that I do have concerns with are the changes to the piece rate employees and what wage those workers would be making. I think you will hear from others that the legislature's intent was around making sure that if you are a piece rate employee that you are paid minimum wage when you're out on sick time. And I guess I would say I'm not sure I necessarily agree with that. When we were having conversations around piece rate employees that I remember from 2015, I think the concern that I heard from legislators at that time was, what if an employee doesn't have a regular rate of pay? They're just a piece rate employee. So what are they paid when they are out for sick time? And I think the key piece of missing information that was not really known or talked about at that time as we were talking about piece rate employees is that there is never an instance that a piece rate or commission employee doesn't have a regular rate of pay. So I think the legislators wanted to make sure that while somebody was out on sick time, they didn't have a zero hourly wage. What we weren't really aware of in those conversations is that even piece rate employees have a regular rate of pay and what that regular rate of pay is, and it's the same for overtime protections, it's the same for minimum wage, is that you have to take a look at what that employee's average wage was for the hours that they worked during that week. So for example, if a piece rate employee works overtime, that you actually have to go back and evaluate what was the average wage that they made for all of the hours that they worked that week and say the piece rate employee made an average of $20 an hour, the overtime that would be due to that employee would be $30 an hour. The same goes for minimum wage. Employers who employ piece rate employees, if that employee, when you do that average calculation and you look back for what did they make every hour, comes in and they only made $6 an hour, the employer still has an obligation to make sure that that employee makes minimum wage. So I guess the piece that I would say is I feel like the changes to the piece rate employees are something that at this point I don't support because I do feel like for all other purposes in wage and hour law, whether it's minimum wage or it's overtime, there is that established regular rate of pay for piece rate employees. Now to the pieces that I don't have objections with. It's funny as I hear the workers' compensation pieces and making sure that sick time doesn't count for the definition of payroll. I didn't have any objections to that provision, but it sounds like that might be coming out now. So those are, I think, my basic concerns around Senate Bill 299. I am happy to keep working with proponents around that LLC language and around the piece rate employees and other provisions. I am hopeful that we can get to a place where this is something that we are supportive of and we can address the technical corrections in it.
Okay, can you kind of, in your mind, so first of all, thank you for that. So can you just share with us what you're thinking time frame wise to be able to work these things out?
It sounds like we're very close on the LLC language, and I'm hopeful. I would, not being an expert in LLCs myself, would like to see what the language that the Farm Bureau is proposing around substantial ownership control is what I heard.
But I think voting
rights, but I think that can be done fairly quickly. I'm hesitant to say without seeing language that.
Mm-hmm. Just to summarize, I think because sick time is something that this body has worked hard on and we've passed, and is we just wanted to understand. So there's that element, the workers' comp.
I don't have any problem with the workers'.
Yep, so that potentially has been addressed. So some of the other areas, the piece rate, you want to?
And the PTO policy.
PTO, okay. All right. So those are some of the areas. Senator Armando Sanderson.
Yes, thank you. And just on the LLC, I mean, I can see where it's even greater than three families when I think of you have the parents and then you have four kids. And in this case, they had eight kids. And not all of them stayed on the farm, but they got married and they had different last names. But they all were very integral part of the estate, I would say. I mean, it's huge. So I would hope that there wouldn't be barriers to the number. And I see where abuse could happen, but I also see where it's very legitimate, you know.
Okay.
Thank you, Senator Monson. Yes. I would just say I think the devil will be in the details, and I look forward to doing that quickly.
Okay. Senator Knopf.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Kate, as it relates to the workers' comp sick time issue, was that just an oversight in the original bill, or was there some intention there?
Senator Taylor, Senator Knope, we never talked about workers' comp and the definition of payroll and whether sick time would be included or not included in it. I think that's something that came up in 2016 as a proposed correction.
Right.
And I'm not familiar enough with workers' comp law. It seems to me like it's a fairly minimal change if you include it or not include it, because overall to your entire salary, we're talking about at maximum 40 hours. But
okay. Anything else? Okay. Thank you. Kate, be on standby, please. Betsy Earls from AOI, she was not able to sign up, but she'd like to come up and testify. And I just want to have you nearby, Kate, in case we have any additional questions, please.
Hi. Hi. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Betsy Earls, representing Associated Oregon Industries and the Oregon Business Association. Sorry for the late entry to the lineup, but I did want to address the question about paid time off policies and whether those are protected by the paid sick leave law or not when they're more generous than what's required by Senate Bill 454, which you passed last session. When the paid sick time law passed last session, employers who were already offering paid time off policies were concerned that they not be required to alter those policies to exactly match the state requirements. This was of particular concern to employers who offered a more generous leave benefit than that was being required by Senate Bill 454. Employers mostly offer a paid time off policy because they don't want to have to track what the employee is doing with those hours. Because the whole point basically of providing PTO is to allow employees to blend their vacation and personal other sick time off as they see fit, without having to track it and without the employee having to report what the time is being used for. So our concern changing that is that Senate Bill 454 sets up penalties for employers who don't comply with the law. And when employers provide more than the 40 hours of leave that's required by the law, we don't want those penalties to apply to any hours after the first 40. If the penalties apply to all those hours that an employer provides for PTO when the policy is more generous than the 40 hours required by the state, employers end up in a situation exactly like what they were concerned about during the session, which is that they have to track all the reasons that employees take time off, and employees have to report the reasons they're taking time off. And you end up in a situation where the employer might as well just go straight to a paid sick time policy and a paid vacation time policy, rather than providing a policy where there are no questions asked and no reporting required. So Senate Bill 454 didn't address the concern directly, despite the fact that many parties agreed about the intent of the bill during session to cover only the first 40 hours with the paid sick time specific protections. Boley felt when we went to rulemaking that there wasn't enough basis in the legislative history to write that requirement into the rule. So that's why we're before you today. I would say it's somewhat unfair to say that employees who take the first 40 hours of their PTO off as vacation won't end up with any job protections at all for their sick leave, because the point of a paid time off policy is to provide paid time off. So I would point out to you that if employees are using that first 40 hours for vacation, they've made the decision to go ahead and do that under a paid time off policy. But they're not. It's not that they won't be left with any time off allowed by the employer at all. They'll still have whatever is left in their paid time off policy. It just won't be subject to the specific notice requirements and protections that are written into Senate Bill 454.
Okay.
So that is why we wanted that in this bill.
Senator Hanselman?
Okay, I think I know where we are. So I'm good.
That's okay. Senator Ivana Sanderson, did you have a question? Okay, all right. Thank you. Does anyone have any clarifying questions for Ms. Newhall? All right, thank you for coming up. Senator Newell, it's your future, it's the end of the day. Did you have anything you wanted to add? Okay, all right. Thank you very much. We're gonna go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 299. Our next meeting is going to be on Wednesday, April 12th. We have some work sessions scheduled. However, I'm going to go ahead and say that I'm not certain that all of them are ready, so we may be moving them, we may not, so we should be on standby. And we're also going to have a public hearing on Senate Bill 560, where Senator Canope is going to be discussing, I believe it's the Dash 10 amendment, correct? He's going to tell us that there's a new amendment for PERS, in case anybody hasn't had enough time to talk about PERS. He has, how many pages is the amendment, Senator Canope?
It's like 50-something.
50-some page amendment. He's going to explain that to us. And but I believe you're going to be sitting up here with us, and we're going to go over it.
Yeah, we're going to read it aloud.
We're going to read it aloud.
Responsibly.
And then we're also going to talk about Senate Bill 999 that I believe, is that your bill, Senator Canope, 999?
I have no idea.
Yeah, okay, it limits the remedies and penalties for wage hour violations.
Let me check.
I think that may be. Is that Senator Canope's bill?
I have no idea.
It's okay. I believe it is your bill.
Thanks for letting me know.
You know. So just to clarify, you don't have that handy. So I believe that that is the case, but I could be wrong. So we're going to have a conversation about that. So I just wanted to talk about what's on the calendar for Wednesday.
Nope.
And what's
not,
that? Is that your bill?
Not my bill.
Okay.
Whose came bill from is? Veterans and Emergency Preparedness Committee.
Okay. Well, that's good to know. Thank you for that clarification. So anything else that anyone wants to bring up, or any questions or concerns? We have two more meetings before the chamber deadline. Senator Hansel.
I do. I just, for the record, want to express my appreciation to you as the chair for how Senate Bill 299 in that whole issue has developed, how the people are working together. And I, from what I heard today, I'm optimistic that we'll get a bill. And I think it would really speak well of this committee, this is my own personal opinion, if we were able to get the bill and take it to the floor.
Okay.
And not send it to rules or some other esoteric committee that we may never see it again. I think if we can get it under your leadership, we had the ownership of it, let's take it to the floor.
Well, okay. Senator Hansel, thank you for that input. I will have to say I'm quite convinced that both all the folks at the table, all the feedback I've gotten is that everybody's all hands on deck and working hard on that, and I want to thank everybody for doing that and for being reasonable about that. So hopefully that will be the case, but we will wait and see, because there will need to be some changes probably, and so we have to make certain that the paperwork and et cetera is there with it. So with that, unless there's anything else, I'm going to go ahead and adjourn the Senate Committee on Workforce. Okay. Yeah, on workforce.